The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Extreme snowfall, extreme cold, followed by extreme flood and avalanche risk. Alaska has always had periods of dramatic weather, but recent long bouts of deep cold and swings from 15 below 1 week to rain the next are difficult and tedious to contend with. How are weather experts and city leaders working to understand and meet the unpredictable weird weather test of the future? We'll learn about planning for weather chaos and disasters today on Talk of Alaska.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, on Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. It's a busy day. The second session of the 34th legislature starts today. Let's hope the weather is cooperative. When I first moved to Anchorage 26 years ago, a neighbor said, if you don't like the weather, just wait 15 minutes. And haha, weather systems from Prince William Sound certainly can spin up quickly, bringing snow or rain into the city. But in that quarter century, the intensity and duration of heavy weather events seems to have increased dramatically. Has it? Is my sense of this change accurate, or does my fear of climate change mean I just pay much closer attention to any kind of erratic weather? Our guests today spend a lot of time thinking about what is happening in our weather systems and how to deal with resulting emergencies. Our longtime friend Brian Brettschneider of our occasional series Ask a Climatologist is here. Brian is a climatologist and senior scientist for the National Weather Service, and he studies the changes that we all know are happening but may not know how to understand. Becky Wendt Pearson is Anchorage's municipal manager, and on the line from Juneau is Robert Barr. Robert is the deputy city manager for the city and borough of Juneau. Welcome, all of you.
Great to be here, Lori.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks for being here. Glad you're all with us. So, to get us started off here, all of you, so many Alaskans have been affected by adverse weather this fall and winter, the terrible Halong disaster on the Kuskokwim that left many Alaskans without homes, deep, prolonged cold in the interior, heavy snowfall in Juneau and Anchorage, high winds and then rain on top of deep snow. Yikes. We're a huge state. How rare is it to have so many Alaskans contending with bad weather at the same time? Brian?
Yeah, so as you noted, there has been a little something for everybody this winter so far, whether it's snow or wind or cold or warm. And it's not uncommon to have, you know, extreme weather affecting one part of the state or another. And this winter, it was more common to have it kind of change hands over from 1 week to the next. But we have had an unusual, uncommon amount of impactful winter weather this season compared really with most winters in the last 10 or 20 years.
What are your thoughts, Becky, about how chaotic it's been and how it compares to past years?
Well, I really think that theme of kind of more of everything happening all at once is really, you know, what we're seeing and what we're preparing for and thinking about from a weather perspective. I mean, this winter we we came into office, our administration really focused on snow, and our snow preparation has really been something we've called upon this winter. But we've also, you know, over the last 6 weeks, one of our major, the major things we've had to focus on is drainage. You know, this deep freeze has been a real water issue for the municipality and has highlighted some of the infrastructure issues we have in the drainage space that require attention. And so I'd say I think we're preparing for everything all at once and flexing all those muscles. We're looking at, you know, avalanche danger in some of the outlying areas of the municipality with respect to infrastructure and human habitation, you know, not necessarily with respect to backcountry travel. Again, that extreme cold and the snow preparation kind of all wrapped up in one this winter.
Mm-hmm. And Robert, your thoughts about, you know, just generally what you've seen. I don't know how long, Robert and Becky, you've been doing this work, but just your thoughts about what a winter it's been to contend with so far. It's only January.
Yeah, this winter has definitely been the hardest one in my tenure here in Juneau. I've been here for 12 years or so now, and we've, you know, a lot of what Becky said, right? Everything from deep, deep, challenging snow that gave us a lot of concerns and some collapsed roofs about roof weight and snow load on those roofs to, you know, rain on top of that snow, on top of that ice, creating significant localized flooding issues to avalanche concern and risk, and all that on top of our annual Glacial Lake outburst flood, which has given us a lot of practice in kind of the emergency management world as well. We're definitely spending a lot more time and money on dealing with emergency management than we have in the past.
Brian, why? What has been going on in the last few months that spun up this multi-front weather chaos?
Well, it really boils down to an upper-level pattern. There's been what we call an upper-level ridge of high pressure that set up over the Bering Sea in the first week of December. And it's not uncommon for that to happen, but not only was it of record strength, but it was almost of record duration. And so for days and days and days, for weeks, literally, the flow around that brought in air from the north, from the northwest, and those are cool to cold air masses. But on either side of those high pressures, you know, you pay the price, right? We have to conserve various things in the atmosphere. You can't just have calm and cold in one area and everyone else is normal. So on the east side of that, and also on the west side in western Russia, we had a deep low pressure, which spins up surface storms, which sends moisture and wind and snow and then rain into southeast. And so it all works together. It's a complete system, and it just depends on where you are with respect to where the center of those features are. So in several of the previous winters, there was a kind of a similar pattern, but it was offset by a few hundred miles, and we were pretty much in the benign sector of that for much of the winter. But everything just kind of set up in the right spot or the wrong spot, as it were, for these highly impactful events.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about Alaska's weird and changing weather. In the studio with me today is Brian Brettschneider. Brian is a senior scientist with the National Weather Service. He's a climatologist. And also in the studio with us is Becky Wint Pearson. Becky is the Anchorage Municipal Manager. And on the line from Juneau is Robert Barr. Robert is the Deputy City Manager for the City and Borough of Juneau. You can join our conversation if you have questions about the weather that you've experienced in your part of the state or what you wonder might be coming in the future. Robert, you had to dump snow in the ocean because of a lack of storage space, correct? Has that happened in the past? And is that allowed?
It has happened in the past. It's relatively rare for us to seek that permission, and we'd have to get special permission from the State Department of Environmental Conservation to do that. It's not something that we like to do. You know, we like to keep our waterways clean, and dumping snow in them carries some risk with that. But we did, because we got as much snow that we would normally see all winter just in the month of December, and we ran out of places to put it. Juneau goes from sea level to mountains pretty quickly. So we have snow dumps, and you know, we use heavy machinery and dump trucks to move that snow to those snow dumps, but they can fill up too. And sometimes just where the snow is, there's just literally nowhere to move it on the side of the roads because they've all filled up and have already gotten down to one lane. So yeah, this particular season required us to dump some into the Gastineau Channel.
Well, I'm hoping that you can give us sort of a snapshot of how dire it was before you could clear enough snow. As an older person, I think about older people when weather gets like this, and you just mentioned being down to one lane. I bet there was a lot of areas that were simply not very easily walkable for quite some time. How were people able to get to medical appointments or to get food and just kind of go about their lives during this situation?
Yeah, it was absolutely challenging for people. Everything from, most of our roofs in Juneau and throughout the state are designed for either 40, or if they're built more recently, 50 pounds per square foot of weight on top of them. And we were over that at a number of our facilities and a number of houses. So getting snow off of roofs was a really big deal here locally during that event. And then just general access. We prioritized keeping public transit open as much as we possibly could on snow routes, of course, but for people whose cars were buried and just couldn't unbury them, being able to take the bus was something that we were able to preserve. It was really hard. We had feet and feet of snow on the ground, and one of the things that I'm proud of, particularly for folks in our neighborhoods, we had a lot of people helping people. Right when there were neighbors that were just, it was clear that they had neighbors that were unable to shovel. You would very quickly see people mobilizing to help those folks.
That's great. It's wonderful to hear about Alaskans helping other Alaskans out. Becky, for Anchorage, you talked a little bit about what you were contending with, but the deep cold, then rain, then high winds. What kind of problems did the long deep freeze followed by rapid warm up and then that crazy rain and sleet and wind? What happened in relation to flooding concerns for the city?
Well, Laurie, as I noted in passing at the beginning of the hour, we really ran into some very serious issues with drainage and with stormwater over the last 6 weeks. You think of the municipality as kind of a giant building full of pipes, right? Our stormwater system, and just like buildings are, pipes are freezing in buildings, our entire stormwater system, our culverts, our ditches, et cetera, the vast majority froze solid in the last 6 weeks in a way we haven't seen in years. And I would say that these kinds of extreme weather events really, I think in my experience, exacerbate underlying challenges with the municipal infrastructure that are there every day, but that really come to the forefront when stretched by this kind of extreme weather. So the Anchorage municipal, stormwater and drainage infrastructure is challenged already. We have, in 2019, we had a study done that estimated we needed $1 billion of capital investment to bring our stormwater and drainage infrastructure up to standard. And that's just within our roads and drainage service area within the core of the municipality. That doesn't take into account outlying areas on the hillside, areas in Girdwood and Chugach Eagle River that all did experience these challenges in the last 6 weeks. So we came into this, with this challenge in managing our stormwater and our drainage, and then all of that really froze rock solid over the last 6 weeks, but water is still moving even when the infrastructure is frozen solid. And so our crews have been working day and night over the last, again, month and a half to steam thaw culverts, to clear ditches, to try and create pathways for water to continue to flow where it's supposed to, as opposed to flowing across roadways and through homes. You may have seen some evidence of this in the past couple weeks as things hit kind of an extreme point where there was, at one point, I believe DOT closed Elmore because there was water flowing across the road. Girdwood has had some very extreme challenges because of the slope of the community, the amount of water that flows through Girdwood. It doesn't usually freeze this solid. And so that is, I think, an under-the-radar challenge that we've been fighting for the last 6 weeks that is extraordinary. And again, highlights some challenges with our infrastructure that have been there that are exacerbated by this kind of extreme weather pattern.
You mentioned $1 billion to upgrade the city's storm and water handling system. When was that amount of money first realized, and how are city officials thinking about that?
Well, that number was generated as part of a study of the possibility of a stormwater utility in Anchorage. That was a real topic of conversation about 6 or 7 years ago. It fell off in the last 3 years. It is something that the mayor has asked us to pick up again. And that is really, I mean, that's the question and the quandary we have. We need an enormous amount of investment in stormwater infrastructure and drainage infrastructure in Anchorage. And we don't necessarily have a source for that. Again, both within our roads and drainage service area where we can bond for infrastructure, and also outside of it, where we don't have that capacity. So we're looking again at that stormwater utility concept, picking up, acknowledging that number, that $1 billion number, is now 7 years out of date. So we, again, exacerbated by weather challenges like this, but really just looking at those underlying infrastructure challenges that we have as a community.
You mentioned that Girdwood also experienced a lot of trouble because of deep freeze and frozen drain systems. How were you able to contend with that and in the main city proper?
Well, I guess I feel like if I can, I want to praise Kyle Kelly, who is who is the lead employee for the municipality in Girdwood, who has been really personally been taking charge of crews down there day and night, just trying to make sure that they're addressing everything, you know, all those frozen culverts and drainage ditches. We've pulled in all kinds of extraordinary resources, contract resources, and to make sure that we're able to, again, get that steam thawing done. And that community has some unique challenges because of the topography, the amount of water that flows there. We were really concerned leading up to last Thursday because that was the tipping point where it had been frozen solid, and then we were going to see this massive swing in temperature followed by a large amount of rain. And that was a test of how well the steam thawing effort had worked to make sure that water was going to, again, flow through the infrastructure as it was intended and not through people's homes.
Mm-hmm. Robert, we know that when all that snow came and then rain on top of it, that was just disastrous for vessels in the harbor. Do you have totals for how many vessels sunk and how many roofs collapsed? And have most of the vessels been recovered, or are there still some underwater?
Yeah, there are still some underwater. We had 10 vessels sink and probably dozens others that were saved through the efforts of our docks and harbor staff and, again, kind of neighbors helping neighbors get their boats clear of snow and ice. It is, of course, a huge problem in a harbor when a vessel sinks, because that potentially causes damage to the harbor infrastructure, and then those boats have to be re-lifted, you know, up out of the water, which is a labor and time and cost intensive effort that we'll be recovering from for some time still.
Brian, atmospheric rivers, just the name really kind of scares me. What are they, and are they becoming more frequent? Juneau was hit by one in December. I think maybe that's what happened to Anchorage leading into the weekend. You can confirm or tell us what happened there. And how should Alaskans think about this and what to expect in future years related to these sort of water inundations from the sky?
Yeah, so atmospheric rivers, it's something that's been known about and discussed in literature for decades. They used to be sometimes referred to as a Pineapple Express. And as you noted, there's been several highly impactful ones that have moved over Alaska in the last number of weeks. The Southeast Alaska one that dumped all the snow in Juneau. And indeed, all the precipitation that fell last week in Anchorage, there was one atmospheric river that literally, it was raining in Honolulu and the stream of moisture went straight north, you know, right into South Central Alaska. And that's what's, you know, has led to this being the wettest January on record for Anchorage. There's not really an indication that atmospheric rivers are increasing in frequency, but there is indication that they are they're carrying more moisture than they used to. Right. And so as the atmosphere warms, it has a higher capacity to hold more moisture. And that's exactly what we're seeing, that, you know, two or three or four atmospheric rivers a year. That's probably about the same as it was before. But now those are, each individual one has a higher ability to carry more moisture, which then leads to a possibility of more extreme precipitation events.
Is the term atmospheric river relatively new? Because, or is that something that in weather circles you've described for many years and the rest of us are just getting familiar with that terminology now?
Yeah, it's decades old. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, the polar vortex, no one had ever heard of it until 10 or 12 years ago, but it's been around since the 1950s. So, you know, it was one of those things that that kind of just the nerds talked about, but now it's all over social media and has been widely utilized in mainstream media as well.
So you did a little of this breakdown, but again, just give us some sort of overview and historical context of what we've seen this winter. So many crazy events, extended cold, heavy snow, high wind, rain, flooding. Talk about where the big surprises or record-breaking events were and how this compares to historical weather anomalies.
So I think looking at the cold first, it was the coldest in decades for most of the state. In fact, the statewide average was, by some measures, the coldest since 1980 for the month of December. We think about these things in terms of whole month increments. January is going to be pretty tricky because the first half of January was very cold, and the second half is going to be very warm compared to normal. And so historically, it may look rather unremarkable, even though it was very impactful for the first half. But pretty much everywhere north of the Alaska Range had their coldest December since 1980. Fairbanks had about 20 days where it was minus 40, which is the most since the 70s, I think. They went 33 days without even getting above zero. Mm. Here in Anchorage, it's been our wettest January on record. We had one of our longest periods where we didn't get above 20 degrees. Juneau obviously had the record-breaking snow, particularly toward the end of December, but they also had their coldest December in 60 years. So it was just really extreme cold first, then the extreme precipitation after that. Now, you know, old timers probably will think about this as being very similar to what it used to be like. And so, you know, prior to 1980, this would have been a completely normal December temperature-wise. We wouldn't think anything about it. But since things have warmed by about, on average, about 7 degrees over the last 50 to 75 years, the fact that we were 8 or 9 degrees above our new normal meant that we were about what we were decades ago. So this is kind of what it was like for the old timers around here.
So 50 or 60 years ago, it would have been even colder?
So given the atmospheric setup of the record high pressure over the Bering Sea, record surface pressure over the Bering Sea, a record low amount of cloud cover, it probably, if this had happened 5-6 decades ago, it probably would have been 7-10 degrees colder. Hmm.
And so when people come at you with, hey, what do you mean the climate's warming? It's cold and it's colder than it was. So what's going on there? How do you help people understand the differences between weird weather and a changing climate? Or at this point, does it not matter that much?
Well, I think most people kind of get it. You know, we forget that January of 2025 was more above normal than December was below normal. So you add December and January together, and it was above normal. 2025 statewide was our sixth warmest year on record. Despite that cold, it would have been about our third warmest, and December bumped it down to about sixth place. And in fact, 2025 was, if you start, I think it was warmer than any year prior to the year 2000 statewide. So so it's Alaska, it's winter, and it can get cold. And the thing is, like I said a minute ago, our cold snaps are not as cold as they used to be. This would have been a much colder cold snap had we been recording this in the 1970s.
The cold weather advisory is something the National Service started in recent years. Tell us about how that's triggered and what prompted it being used here in Alaska, where cold is, as you just said, you know, it's Alaska. We expect to be cold in the winter.
So this is a new product that we've only started issuing about 2 years ago. And as Becky would probably attest to, cities are built for the climate that they have, the infrastructure, the services, the budgets, and an unusual level of cold is going to be impactful. You know, I like to say, you know, someone in Fairbanks is probably just fine when it's 40 below zero. But if they were to get on a flight and go to South Alabama, where it was in the teens yesterday, and there might have been power outages and electrical heat and poor insulation, it would be more impactful for them at 15 degrees than it would be for them at 40 below back home. So because the way we build our cities, what we kind of came to the realization of is that a level of cold that happens 1 or 2 or 3 days a year, that's impactful no matter where you are, whether you're in Fairbanks or Dallas or New York or Las Vegas. And a level of cold that only happens once every couple of years is really extreme. And so that's why we have these cold weather advisories and extreme cold warnings. So for the city of Anchorage, minus 25 degrees is the threshold. So if the temperature of the wind chill is forecast to hit minus 25, which on average happens about one time a year, you get a cold weather advisory. For Fairbanks, that threshold is minus 55. So in theory, that's an equivalent level of cold for them. It happens 1 or 2 times a year. And again, that this is a program for the entire United States. So Miami just had a cold weather advisory. They were expecting wind chills of 30 degrees. But they don't have coats. They don't have insulation. And that's very impactful for them.
And Fairbanks is sort of the city of extremes. It gets very cold in the winter, gets very hot in the summer. They had a heat advisory. And I believe that was the first one for Fairbanks. Is that right?
Well, that's an even newer product. So heat advisories have been around for decades in the lower 48. But we never even thought about having heat advisories for Alaska. And I think as a lot of listeners, particularly in Anchorage, will remember back in 2019 when it hit 90 degrees, that was miserable. It was very uncomfortable because our houses are built trap heat, not to ventilate heat. And so with 20 hours of daylight, the warm temperatures, it was impossible to keep houses cold. And so 90 degrees in Dallas, no big deal. They probably would feel grateful for that in July and August, but because their houses are built for it. But here is very impactful. So this is the first year that it was available as a tool in the toolkit for parts of Alaska. And so I think for Fairbanks, if the temperature is forecast to get between 85 and 90, that triggers a heat advisory. And Southeast Alaska actually had a number as well. And the criteria vary by location. But that's something that people should probably expect to see more of in the coming years.
Well, and as you've discussed in the past on our air, that the sun feels hotter here, too, because it's right in your grill. It's not overhead. It's right in your face.
Yeah, exactly. It's just heat. As people know who have family that travel up from the lower 48, 75 degrees in Anchorage feels really hot.
Yeah, see, we're not wimps. It does feel really hot.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Definitely not wimps.
No, that's for sure, especially after this winter. All right, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the crazy weather this winter and what it may tell us about the future as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing Alaska's changing weather and what the future may hold with our guest today, Brian Brettschneider. Brian is a National Weather Service senior scientist and a climatologist. And Becky Wendt-Pierson is the Anchorage Municipal Manager. They're both in the studio with me today. Robert Barr is the deputy city manager for the city and borough of Juneau, and he is joining us through the studios of our dear friends at KTOO. Doug says, I've just been catching bits and pieces of the discussion, but what about wind? Seems there have been a lot of wind events, more than I recall in my 35 years in Anchorage. It's an interesting question because when I first moved here about 26 years or so ago, I at various times was kind of amazed at some of the wind events that occasionally kick up in Anchorage. So does it seem like there's more, or is it just that sometimes Anchorage gets windy?
So this December was by all measures probably the windiest December on record for Anchorage, at least as measured at the Anchorage International Airport. Mm. And then up in Palmer, at the airport there, it was their windiest month that we have reliable records for any month, not just December. One thing I like to say is no matter where you are, where you go, everyone always feels that it's windier than it used to be. And the numbers really just don't bear that out. There's really no trend in wind speeds over time. I think we just kind of remember when there was a big wind, that we feel like this seems unusual. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember it like that before, but really, there's no indication that things are windier than they used to be.
Well, I know that in 2012, we had a tremendous windstorm that took down a lot of trees. It was bad conditions. Leaves are still on the trees. The ground wasn't frozen. Man, that was a mess. But this latest wind event was dramatic, but certainly didn't cause that level of damage here.
Yeah, so the wind that we've had this winter, we call them Bora wind events. And those are a northerly wind events where we get high pressure over the eastern interior and Yukon territory, and it kind of gets forced through the terrain, through the Matanuska Valley, over Palmer, and down over West Anchorage. So, so interestingly, the strongest winds that the airport ever measures are from those events. But if you live in much of the rest of Anchorage, the strongest winds are from the southeast Chinook events, and they have completely different origins, and then also completely different impacts. Because, like you mentioned, a lot of the southeast Chinook winds can happen in the fall when there's no snow on the ground. The ground isn't frozen, and that makes trees more vulnerable to being pushed over. Of course, these Bora north wind events are accompanied by blowing snow, low wind chills, and so they have their own impacts for sure.
All right, I want to get. Becky, did you want to?
Oh, I was just going to add on the wind front. I mean, I can't comment on whether it's windier than it used to be. You know, Brian is really the expert on that. But I would say that from a management perspective of municipal assets, the winds we've had in recent years have again highlighted some of these questions about where we have potential weaknesses in our infrastructure. Remember, probably everyone remembers the pedestrian bridge that blew over, the Rabbit Creek pedestrian bridge that blew into the highway in January of 2025, and it prompted us to take a more comprehensive look in Anchorage at all of our pedestrian bridge infrastructure. Much of it was built in the Project 80s era. It's hitting the point where we have some vulnerability to extreme weather events. We had a number of mobile homes that lost roofs in Anchorage during that wind event also. And our mobile home stock is also at the point in its aging and has had challenges with rebuilding and repair under our building code. So we've been looking at that too. So I would say that it's a challenge that we have to confront in terms of making sure that we are weatherproofing our infrastructure, especially as a state that's hitting that age, and a community, particularly in Anchorage, where we're hitting the age of it with our infrastructure, where it needs that refresh to make sure we can withstand these wind events, whether or not they're more frequent than they used to be or not.
Yeah, that makes sense. When you live in a climate that has so much freeze-thaw, it's hard on everything. And so infrastructure does break down over time. Becky, at some point in the future, Anchorage, and Brian can tell me if I'm way off here, but Anchorage may be more like Seattle, it seems to me, with more rain than snow. But I also feel like a number of transition years, we're going to likely see more ice. That seems like it would be a lot more challenging than pushing snow around. So is it, and how are you planning for what could happen when there's not as much clarity as you'd probably like for planning?
That's a good question, Lorraine. I don't think it's necessarily more challenging. You know, it just requires a different set of, you know, different pieces of infrastructure. We, you know, we came in with a real task to try and take a look at our snow removal infrastructure. And we've spent the last 2 years really picking apart, you know, the different pieces of that equation, trying to improve our operator pay, our ability to retain operators, reclassifying positions, making sure we have full staffing to be able to operate our snow fleet. We added a heavy equipment levy, which helps support all of the different types of vehicles we use to remove snow and ice. You know, snow presents the unique challenge of where do you put it. As Robert mentioned, the challenges I faced in Juneau, we've faced those same challenges here with, do we have enough snow dump space to put snow when we've removed it from our roadways? Ice is just a different flavor of challenge. We need a different set of vehicles. We still need operators. We need, you know, a different set of chemicals and aggregate to be able to address ice. And so we are working on trying to fold everything we do as part of our ice response into the things we've developed for our snow response. You may notice this winter we piloted a program where you can track all of our plows and live the time online. You can see Lady Gaga moving around your neighborhood. So we don't yet have our sanders as part of that, but they anticipate they're coming soon. So you can we'll have another naming competition for Sandy McSanderson or whatever we want to add. So we, again, I think it's not necessarily a bigger challenge. It's just a different flavor. And so I think we'll have to, as we see more, our team is adept at dealing with ice. As we see more ice events and potentially less snow events, we will have to adapt over time, adapt the vehicles we include in our fleet, adapt the things that we, you know, that we, what we stock, what we're prepared for. But again, we have a really good team. I think we'll, you know, we'll build into that as we evolve.
Beyond dealing with the direct effects of local weather conditions, we saw people displaced by Halong that had to come to Anchorage for housing. How are you thinking about this potential of weather disasters in rural parts of the state that will force people to move to Anchorage at least temporarily? Local emergency management is focused on local needs, correct? So how are you adjusting to these larger statewide needs?
That's a really good question, Lori, and that was a really unique experience this fall for Anchorage as a community, responding to the needs of our neighbors from Western Alaska who were displaced by Typhoon Halong. And as you noted, emergency management paradigms are really built around the idea of a community saying something has happened here in our community. We need help from outside, and we need to, you know, loosen our rules so that we can respond more quickly. That's my very rudimentary, basic, you know, summary of kind of how the, you know, an emergency declaration works. And we found in responding to Typhoon Halong, you know, that paradigm doesn't quite fit with a community responding to a disaster that has happened outside of its borders. We actually made an adaptation to Anchorage's municipal code this fall in response to Typhoon Halong. We modified the definition of a civil emergency in Title III to add that there could be a triggering event that initiated outside of Anchorage's borders that required Anchorage to expend extraordinary resources or use municipal resources differently than usually, maybe need to change municipal code or rules for the time period of the emergency. So we made that change in order to be able to respond and adapt to the needs of our neighbors who came and were hosted in Anchorage and remain in Anchorage to date. And, you know, the state and I think the federal government will have to adapt to these types of emergencies over time as well. Right now, where the state is treating the municipality as a vendor, which is sort of an extraordinary model for emergency management, as though we're, you know, Anchorage RS providing housing and policing services and traffic management in response to, which is because this is something of an out-of-the-box and a paradigm. The only example we could find was in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, there was a model where the federal disaster declaration did include some communities not impacted by the hurricane who were in the same place that Anchorage was, the hosting space of hosting people who were displaced by the weather event and having to stretch community resources in response. So it's a unique paradigm and certainly something that we are anticipating we will do again as a community, that this won't be the last time that Anchorage is called upon as a host community to support other parts of the state experiencing extreme weather.
Brian, we had a question from Tricia who says, seems that the weather on my phone does not track as accurately as in the past. Have recent and ongoing federal funding cuts impacted our ability to access reliable weather data?
That's a great question. And, you know, cell phone weather apps are kind of a black box. Every provider, every manufacturer has contracts with different vendors. They all work a little bit different. Some of them do try to do some personalization. I certainly, frequently, I'll have a neighbor say, hey, I see we're supposed to get, you know, X inches of snow, or it's supposed to be this temperature. And I'll try to tell them, well, that's not really what the forecast says. So, you know, really buyer beware with what your phone says as far as the weather. Now, I work for the National Weather Service, and I totally get that 90% of weather information that people get is from their phone. And that's just the reality of where things are now. But as far as a hazardous weather, watches, warnings, advisories, those only come from the National Weather Service. So hopefully those apps are passing those along. But I've certainly seen some horrendous, I mean, on my phone, it'll tell me, you know, snow is about to start soon. And
yeah,
you know,
like in 15 minutes or something.
I kind of yell at my phone.
Like,
I said, you don't know what you're talking about. And
I
so,
do that too.
So cell phone weather apps, you know, those and a couple of quarters will get you a cup of coffee.
Robert, I want to get you back in here. Do you feel like you have a good handle now on roof damage, especially for schools and other public facilities that will need to be repaired? Are there some buildings that need to remain closed until fixed because of safety concerns?
Yeah, thankfully, none of the latter. So we brought in an engineering team from outside, as well as used local engineers to constantly inspect the roofs of our public facilities as snow was piling up on them. And once we exceeded their design snow loads, we did close some facilities, including some schools, out of concern of potential roof collapse. And we did see roof damage in a number of our public facilities that were that didn't rise to the level of us not being able to operate those after the snow was off of the roofs, but that will have to be repaired. We also lost a couple of commercial facilities and one of our largest, if not the largest, grocery store in town, Fred Meyer, had to be closed for a number of days, kind of off and on, due to concern of roof loading. So you can imagine the concern that creates, right, when your kind of major source or one of the major sources of food is no longer available. So that was definitely a struggle for us.
And what about the avalanche risk? Is there still risk currently, or do you feel like the immediate danger is over for now?
Well, we live in a community that is surrounded by mountains, and when there's snow on those mountains, there is risk. So yes, there is still risk, but the risk is no longer so high that we have any evacuation advisories in place. We did for a while. We had an evacuation advisory in place for all of our major downtown avalanche chutes, and then eventually that became just one of our major downtown avalanche chutes. And when we have an evacuation advisory in place, we also have a shelter stood up so that people have somewhere to go if they don't have friends or family they can stay with. And we had 50 people in that shelter at its height during the height of our avalanche risk. That's just something that we have to manage, right, when that comes up. And of course, we're grateful for the Red Cross for helping us out with those sheltering activities when they have to happen. And the state has been a great help too. They have a lot of avalanche expertise that we're able to lean on to really understand the science and the technical details behind avalanche risk in any given area.
All right, thank you for that. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Alaska's changing weather as Talk of Alaska continues. AK Saltwater Charters writes, I remember weather like December in the late 80s. At that time, it was attributed to an omega block. This time around, it's caused by the polar vortex. Are these the same? Brian?
So an omega block, I think of it like the Greek letter omega, where the center part of it is a big high pressure system, and that's to some degree what we had over the Bering Sea this really for the entire month of December. It was just there day after day after day. Polar vortex is quite a bit different. That's a very high stratospheric level phenomenon. There's also a tropospheric polar vortex. Those we really think about those much more with cold air outbreaks in the lower 48, not so much Alaska. Really, because we get so little solar energy, it's having kind of the right atmospheric setup locally that if you can clear out the clouds and you can calm the winds down, you can release heat back out into space nearly 24 hours a day, and it can get colder and colder with time.
Becky, you mentioned this estimate, this very large estimate, to sort of upgrade the city's storm water handling system and drainage, moving water through the city. My colleagues will roll their eyes when they hear this, and if they're listening in the newsroom, because I have talked a lot about, I've long been interested in how our city handles what must be a tremendous amount of drainage from the Chugach Mountains flowing through the city to Cook Inlet through those various waterways. Now that we're seeing heavier precipitation and the prospect of more ice than snow, how are you planning for this in future years? We have a large number of underground culverts for various creeks in the city. That's kind of a fascinating system in itself. Were they built with climate change in mind? How long has that system been in place? And do you think the system will keep up in coming decades if more flooding or more heavy precipitation is likely?
Oh, gosh, that's a good series of questions. I'd say, you know, as I noted, that the estimate for what we need to bring our stormwater and drainage infrastructure up to standard is enormous, because our system is very old and it has not been upgraded to address, you know, the modern standards that it needs to be, the need to be addressed. And you mentioned runoff from the mountains, and I'd say that our ability to adequately address stormwater flow on the hillside is particularly challenged, because that's an area that's outside of our roads and drainage service area where we don't have the ability to bond for capital projects. And so the ability for the municipality to build and control stormwater infrastructure on the hillside is very limited. And so again, this is where, I mean, the solution we're exploring is the stormwater utility that would provide us with an area-wide solution to be able to generate revenue and invest it exclusively in a stormwater system, in a drainage system, that would be able to pick apart that challenge, layer on top of our bonding ability, and bring that additional funding to play to be able to upgrade that system. But it's absolutely a very serious issue that we're going to have to run into one way or another in the years to come, because our system is so out of date, the needs on it are growing, and because we don't have a good solution for the areas outside of the roads and drainage service area. So again, that's the current, we're picking back up that idea of the stormwater utility as a possible solution, again, that would help to generate the resources and allow for a centralized management structure to be able to deal with that coming challenge.
And Robert, I hadn't thought about this until an earlier interview when you were talking about, you know, reminding us of the fact that people can't just drive to Juneau if you need help. So when you needed extra help, how did you get that? What were the logistical challenges of getting more equipment and things that you needed to help kind of shovel everybody out into the city?
Yeah, it all just takes a little bit longer, right? So we had to get, at one point we had a chartered jet full of those really large push shovels that are particularly effective at clearing snow off of large flat roofs. We didn't have enough of those in town. That actually happened twice. We have some friends in Anchorage that that bought a whole bunch of shovels from Lowe's up there for us and put those on an Alaska Airlines jet. And we brought in a lot of contractors from down south, 250 of them, to get on school roofs and get snow off of roofs. And DOT brought down a large piece of heavy equipment that basically an industrial-sized snowblower from Fairbanks. And so that had to travel down through Anchorage and get on a ferry and make its way to Juneau. So it's just more complex from a logistical perspective. I'll also just kind of follow on what Becky was talking about, storm drainage. Another reason why storm drainage investment is so important is that you really don't want your stormwater making its way into your utility system, into your wastewater system, and because that just like makes that much more complicated when you're having to treat water that you shouldn't have to treat. So that's one thing that we think a lot about here in Juneau when we're dealing with stormwater and drainage upgrades and improvements, is keeping those two things separate.
And Robert and Becky, talk about how you work with the state. We only have a few minutes left here. During these emergency weather events, Becky, Anchorage has a road system that's maintained by both state and municipal workers. Robert, there's crossover when it comes to avalanche monitoring. How do you coordinate when things start getting dicey, and who takes the lead? Is it local or state officials?
It's a good question. I mean, we have ongoing communication at every level, I'd say, with the state when we're in the midst of an extreme weather event. And for us, as you noted, it frequently has to do with roads during a snow or ice event, because the Anchorage road system is not all maintained municipally. Several of our significant roads are maintained by the state of Alaska Department of Transportation. And so we have communication at the operational level, communication at my level, and communication at various levels in between to make sure that we're in sync. We always have preparatory meetings prior to the winter season. It's not always perfect. We're always dealing with challenges like, you know, we'll plow a sidewalk and then the state will plow snow into the sidewalk and we'll plow the sidewalk again, or vice versa. And I would say we each take the lead with respect to our own infrastructure. We don't actually tuck under one another in Anchorage with respect to road work. We're responsible for our roads. The state is responsible for their roads. We're not necessarily, again, accountable to one agency as lead, but we're just parallel. We have parallel accountability for the roads within our purview.
How about in Juneau for the city and borough and the state, Robert?
Yeah, I would say it's largely the same as what Becky described. We usually, not always, but we usually operate under that similar model where we have our own areas of responsibility for our own infrastructure, both on the streets and roads perspective and from an avalanche risk perspective. So, you know, DOT is great at monitoring avalanche risk, and they really focus on the potential impact of those avalanches on their infrastructure. And we focus on the potential impact of those avalanches on residential areas of town. The only exception to that model where we, you know, normally operate in parallel is during our what has become now kind of catastrophic annual summer glacial lake outburst floods, which is kind of a whole separate climate topic.
Yeah.
And in that model, we do operate under a kind of more unified command where we share responsibility with more agencies too, our tribe as well.
All right. Thank you so much. Brian, a question from Susan. Can you tell us what a Willawa is, and do we get many of those? Do they cause damage like the other types of windstorms?
So a Willawa is kind of a local term for a wind kind of coming over the Chugach Mountains, usually something similar to a Chinook wind. And of course, those can be highly damaging, particularly in the east part of town, and occasionally in the south part of Anchorage. More typically in the fall, although they could happen anytime in the winter, but they present challenges that are different than what we experienced here this winter, but they are highly impactful.
And am I right in my long-held assumption that the Chugach Mountains have for a long time been sort of this barrier, that they kind of sucked up weather that was coming from Prince William Sound so that the vast majority of it didn't actually get to the city, that if you wanted a lot of snow, you drove to Girdwood, which is kind of nice because we don't want all that snow in the city. But is that changing now? Are the weather systems getting stronger so that they're pushing past the mountains more?
Well, you're exactly right that they act as a barrier to moisture, right? So Portage gets 10 times the precipitation that Anchorage does, even though they're only 50 miles away at the same elevation. And so to the extent that are we getting more precipitation? Everyone's getting more precipitation. You know, 2023 was the wettest year statewide in Alaska. 2025 was just barely a notch behind that. And so it's just getting wetter everywhere, and that's going to mean even for places on the what we call the lee side of mountain ranges, the dry side, So we've certainly seen a 5 to 8% increase in precipitation here in Anchorage over the last several decades. And, you know, we should expect that to continue as temperatures increase.
Well, that's how we'll end it then, is that you know what to look forward to in the future, folks. Thanks to our guests, Brian Brettschneider, Becky Wint Pearson, and Robert Barr. Thanks to our engineer, Crystal Hyde, our editor, Annie Feit, on the phones, Ava White helped us out today, and our producer, Madeline Rose. We're sad to say goodbye to our dear friend, colleague, and show producer, Madeline. This is the last Talk of Alaska she'll produce for us. Maddie is heading to Colorado in February for a new producer job with Colorado Public Radio. Best wishes, Maddie. We're sure going to miss you. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.